against war. Trade is the path of coexistence, cooperation. Peace feeds on prosperity. That's why, haunted as I was by the Vietnam War, I always vowed that someday Nike would have a factory in or near Saigon. By 1997, we had four. I was very proud. And when I learned that we were to be honored and celebrated by the Vietnamese government as one of the nation's top five generators of foreign currency, I felt that I simply had to visit. What a wrenching trip. I don't know if I'd appreciated the full depth of my hatred for the war in Vietnam until I returned 25 years after the peace, until I joined hands with our former antagonists. At one point, my hosts graciously asked what they could do for me, what would make my trip special or memorable. I got a lump in my throat. I didn't want them to go to any trouble, I said. But they insisted. Okay, I said, okay, I'd like to meet 86-year-old General Vo Nguyen Giap, the Vietnamese MacArthur, the man who single-handedly defeated the Japanese, the French, the Americans, and the Chinese. My hosts stared in amazed silence. Slowly they rose and excused themselves and stood off in a corner, conversing in frantic Vietnamese. After 5 minutes they came back. Tomorrow, they said. 1 hour. I bowed deeply, then counted the minutes until the big meeting. The first thing I noticed as General Giap entered the room was his size. This brilliant fighter, this genius tactician who'd organized the Tet Offensive, who'd planned those miles and miles of underground tunnels, this giant of history, came up to my shoulders. He was maybe 5'4". And humble. No corncob pipe for Giap. I remember that he wore a dark business suit like mine. I remembered that he smiled as I did, shyly, uncertainly. But there was an intensity about him. I'd seen that kind of glittery confidence in great coaches and great business leaders, the elite of the elite. I never saw it in a mirror. He knew I had questions. He waited for me to ask them. I said simply, "How did you do it?" I thought I saw the corners of his mouth flicker, a smile, maybe. He thought and thought. "I was," he said, "a professor of the jungle." Thoughts of Asia always lead back to Nisho. Where on earth would we have been without Nisho? And without Nisho's former CEO, Masuro Hayami. I got to know him well after Nike went public. We couldn't help but bond. I was his most profitable client and his most avid pupil. And he was perhaps the wisest man I ever knew. Unlike many other wise men, he drew great peace from his wisdom. I fed off that peace. In the 1980s, whenever I went to Tokyo, Hayami would invite me for the weekend to his beach house near Atami, the Japanese Riviera. We'd always leave Tokyo late Friday by rail and have a cognac along the way. Within an hour, we'd be at the Izu Peninsula, where we'd stop at some marvelous restaurant for dinner. The next morning, we'd play golf, and Saturday night, we'd have a Japanese-style barbecue in his backyard. We'd solve all the world's problems. Or I'd give him my problems, and he'd solve them. On one trip, we ended the evening in Hayami's hot tub. I recall above the foaming water the sound of the distant ocean slapping the shore. I recall the cool smell of the wind through the trees, thousands and thousands of coastal trees, dozens of species not found in any Oregon forest. And yet, trees are trees. They always have your back. I recall the jungle crows calling in the distance as we discussed the infinite, then the finite. I complained about my business. Even after going public, there were so many problems. We have so much opportunity, but we're having a terrible time getting managers who can seize those opportunities. We try people from the outside, but they fail because our culture is so different. Mr. Hayami nodded. "See those bamboo trees up there?" he asked. Yes. Next year, when you come, they will be 1 foot higher. I stared. I understood. When I returned to Oregon, I tried hard to cultivate and grow the management team we had, slowly, with more patience, with an eye toward more training and more long-term planning. I took the wider, longer view. It worked. The next time I saw Hayami, I told him. He merely nodded, once, hi, and looked off. Almost 3 decades ago, Harvard and Stanford began studying Nike and sharing their research with other universities, which has created many opportunities for me to visit different colleges, to take part in stimulating academic discussions, to continue to learn. It's always a happy occasion to be walking a campus, but also bracing. Because while I find students today much smarter and more competent than in my time, I also find them far more pessimistic. Occasionally, they ask in dismay, where is the U.S. going? Where's the world going? Or, where are the new entrepreneurs? Or, are we doomed as a society to a worse future for our children? I tell them about the devastated Japan I saw in 1962. I tell them about the rubble and ruins that somehow gave birth to wise men like Hayami and Ito and Sumeragi. I tell them about the untapped resources, natural and human, that the world has at its disposal, the abundant ways and means to solve its many crises. All we have to do, I tell the students, is work and study. Study and work, hard as we can. Put another way, we must all be professors of the jungle. I turn out the lights, walk upstairs to bed. Curled up with a book beside her, Penny has drifted off. That chemistry, that in-sync feeling from day one, accounting 101, remains. Our conflicts, such as they are, have centered mostly on work versus family. Finding a balance. Defining that word, balance. At our most trying moments, we've managed to emulate those athletes I most admire. We've held on, pressed through. And now we've endured. I slide under the covers, gingerly, so as not to wake her, and I think of others who've endured. Hayes lives on a farm in the Tualatin Valley, 108 rolling acres, with a ridiculous collection of bulldozers and other heavy equipment. His pride and joy is a John Deere JD450C. It's bright school bus yellow and as big as a one-bedroom condo. He has some health problems, but he bulldozes ahead. Woodell lives in Central Oregon with his wife. For years, he flew his own private airplane, giving the middle finger to everyone who said he'd be helpless. Above all, flying private meant he never again had to worry about an airline losing his wheelchair. He's one of the best storytellers in the history of Nike. My favorite, naturally, is the one about the day we went public. He sat his parents down and told them the news. "What does that mean?" they whispered. "It means your original $8,000 loan to Phil is worth $1.6 million." They looked at each other, looked at Woodell. "I don't understand," his mother said. If you can't trust the company your son works for, who can you trust? When he retired from Nike, Woodell became head of the Port of Portland, managing all the rivers and the airports. A man immobilized, guiding all that motion. Lovely. He's also the leading shareholder and director of a thriving microbrewery. He always did like his beer. But whenever we get together for dinner, he tells me, of course, his greatest joy and proudest accomplishment is his college-bound son, Dan. Woodell's old antagonist, Johnson, lives slap in the middle of a Robert Frost poem somewhere in the wilds of New Hampshire. He's converted an old barn into a 5-story mansion, which he calls his fortress of solitude. Twice divorced, he's filled the place to the rafters with dozens of reading chairs and thousands of books, and he keeps track of them all with an extensive card catalog. Each book has its own number and its own index card, listing author, date of publication, plot summary, and its precise location in the fortress. Of course. Scampering and prancing around Johnson's spread are countless wild turkeys and chipmunks, most of whom he's named. He knows them all so well, so intimately, he can tell you when one is late in hibernating. Beyond in the distance, nestled in a field of tall grass and swaying maples, Johnson has built a second barn, a sacred barn, which he's painted and lacquered and furnished and filled with overflow from his personal library, plus pallets of used books he buys at library sales. He calls this book utopia Hoarders, and he keeps it lighted, open, free, 24 hours a day, for any and all who need a place to read and think. That's full-time employee number one. In Europe, I'm told there are t-shirts that read, "Where is Jeff Johnson?" Like the famous opening line from Ayn Rand, "Who is John Galt?" The answer is, right where he should be. When it came rolling in, the money affected us all. Not much, and not for long, because none of us was ever driven by money. But that's the nature of money. Whether you have it or not, whether you want it or not, whether you like it or not, it will try to define your days. Our task as human beings is not to let it. I bought a Porsche. I tried to buy the Clippers and wound up in a lawsuit with Donald Sterling. I wore sunglasses everywhere, indoors and out. There's a photo of me in a 10-gallon gray cowboy hat. I don't know where or when or why. I had to get it all out of my system. Even Penny wasn't immune. Overcompensating for the insecurity of her childhood, she walked around with thousands of dollars in her purse. She bought hundreds of staples, like rolls of toilet paper at a time. It wasn't long before we were back to normal. Now, to the extent that she and I ever think about money, we focus our efforts on a few specific causes. We give away $100 million each year, and when we're gone, we'll give away most of what's left. At the moment, we're in the midst of building a gleaming new basketball facility at the University of Oregon, the Matthew Knight Arena. The logo at half court will be Matthew's name, in the shape of a torii gate. From the profane to the sacred. We're also finishing construction on a new athletic facility, which we plan to dedicate to our mothers, Dot and Loda. On a plaque next to the entrance will go an inscription, "Because mothers are our first coaches." Who can say how differently everything would have turned out? Everything. If my mother hadn't stopped the podiatrist from surgically removing that wart and hobbling me for an entire track season. Or if she hadn't told me I could run fast. Or if she hadn't bought that first pair of limber-ups, putting my father in his place. Whenever I go back to Eugene and walk the campus, I think of her. Whenever I stand outside Hayward Field, I think of the silent race she ran. I think of all the many races that each of us have run. I lean against the fence and look at the track and listen to the wind, thinking of Bowerman with his string tie blowing behind him. I think of Pre. God love him. Turning, looking over my shoulder, my heart leaps. Across the street stands the William Knight Law School, a very serious-looking edifice. No one ever jackasses around in there. I can't sleep. I can't stop thinking about that blasted movie, The Bucket List. Lying in the dark, I ask myself again and again, what's on yours? Pyramids? Check. Himalayas? Check. Ganges? Check. So, nothing. I think about the few things I want to do. Make a couple of other universities better. Help find a cure for cancer. Besides that, it's not so much things I want to do as things I'd like to say, and maybe unsay. It might be nice to tell the story of Nike. Everyone else has told the story, or tried to. But they always get half the facts, if that, and none of the spirit. Or vice versa. I might start the story, or end it, with regrets. The hundreds, maybe thousands, of bad decisions. I'm the guy who said Magic Johnson was a player without a position who'll never make it in the NBA. I'm the guy who tabbed Ryan Leaf as a better NFL quarterback than Peyton Manning. It's easy to laugh those off. Other regrets go deeper. Not phoning Hiroku Iwano after he quit. Not getting Bo Jackson renewed in 1996. Joe Paterno. Not being a good enough manager to avoid layoffs. 3 times in 10 years, a total of 1,500 people. It still haunts. Of course, above all, I regret not spending more time with my sons. Maybe if I had, I could have solved the secret code of Matthew Knight. And yet I know that this regret clashes with my secret regret, that I can't do it all over again. God, how I wish I could relive the whole thing. Short of that, I'd like to share the experience, the ups and downs, so that some young man or woman somewhere, going through the same trials and ordeals, might be inspired or comforted or warned. Some young entrepreneur, maybe, some athlete or painter or novelist might press on. It's all the same drive, the same dream. It would make me happy to help them avoid the typical discouragements. I tell them to hit pause, think long and hard about how they want to spend their time and with whom they want to spend it for the next 40 years. I tell men and women in their mid-20s not to settle for a job or a profession or even a career. Seek a calling. Even if you don't know what that means, seek it. If you're following your calling, the fatigue will be easier to bear. The disappointments will be fuel. The highs will be like nothing you've ever felt. I'd like to warn the best of them, the iconoclasts, the innovators, the rebels, that they will always have a bullseye on their backs. The better they get, the bigger the bullseye. It's not one man's opinion. It's a law of nature. I'd like to remind them that America isn't the entrepreneurial Shangri-La people think. Free enterprise always irritates the kinds of trolls who live to block, to thwart, to say, nope, sorry, no. And it's always been this way. Entrepreneurs have always been outgunned, outnumbered. They've always fought uphill, and the hill has never been steeper. America is becoming less entrepreneurial, not more. A Harvard Business School study recently ranked all the countries of the world in terms of their entrepreneurial spirit. America ranked behind Peru. And those who urge entrepreneurs to never give up? Charlatans. Sometimes you have to give up. Sometimes knowing when to give up, when to try something else, is genius. Giving up doesn't mean stopping. Don't ever stop. Luck plays a big role. Yes, I'd like to publicly acknowledge the power of luck. Athletes get lucky. Poets get lucky. Businesses get lucky. Hard work is critical. A good team is essential. Brains and determination are invaluable. But luck may decide the outcome. Some people might not call it luck. They might call it Tao or Logos. Or Jnana, or Dharma, or Spirit, or God. Put it this way. The harder you work, the better your Tao. And since no one has ever adequately defined Tao, I now try to go regularly to Mass. I would tell them, have faith in yourself, but also have faith in faith. Not faith as others define it, faith as you define it. Faith as faith defines itself in your heart. In what format do I want to say all this? A book? No, probably not a book. I can't imagine how I could fit it all into one unified narrative. Maybe a speech or a series of speeches. Maybe just a letter to my grandkids. I peer into the dark. So maybe there is something on my bucket list after all. Maybe. Another crazy idea. Suddenly my mind is racing. People I need to call, things I need to read. I'll have to get in touch with Waddell. I should see if we have any copies of those letters from Johnson. There were so many. Somewhere in my parents' house, where my sister Joanne still lives, there must be a box with my slides from my trip around the world. So much to do. so much to learn, so much I don't know about my own life. Now I really can't sleep. I get up, grab a yellow legal pad from my desk. I go to the living room and sit in my recliner. A feeling of stillness, of immense peace, comes over me. I squint at the moon shining outside my window, the same moon that inspired the ancient Zen masters to worry about nothing. In the timeless, clarifying light of that moon, I begin to make a list.
Shoe Dog, a memoir by the creator of Nike, was written by Phil Knight and read by Norbert Leo Butz, with an introduction read by the author. It was recorded at CDM Studios and at Beat Street in New York. Editing and post-production by Frogpond Productions. Terry Hogan was the mix engineer. The associate producer was Ben Rimmelauer. Shoe Dog was produced and directed by Tara Thomas. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. Shoe Dog is available in print from Scribner.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.